The human head is of the same approximate size and weight as a roaster chicken. I have never before had occasion to make the comparison, for never before today have I seen a head in a roasting pan. But here are 40 of them, one per pan, resting face up on what looks to be a small pet food bowl. The heads are for plastic surgeons, two per head, to practice on. I'm observing a facial anatomy and facelift refresher course sponsored by a Southern University Medical Center and led by a half dozen of America's most sought-after facelifters. The heads have been put in roasting pans, which are of the disposable aluminum variety, for the same reason chickens are put in roasting pans, to catch the drippings. Surgery, even surgery upon the dead, is a tidy, orderly affair. 40 folding utility tables have been draped in lavender plastic cloths, and a roasting pan is centered on each. Skin hooks and retractors are set out with the pleasing precision of restaurant cutlery. The whole thing has the look of a catered reception. I mentioned to the young woman whose job it was to set up the seminar this morning that the lavender gives the room a cheery sort of Easter party feeling. Her name is Teresa. She replies that lavender was chosen because it is a soothing color. For the moment, you can't see the faces. They've been draped with white cloths, pending the arrival of the surgeons. When you first enter the room, you see only the tops of heads, which are shaved down to stubble. You could be looking at rows of old men reclining in barber chairs with hot towels on their faces. The situation only starts to become dire when you make your way down the rows. Now you see stumps, and the stumps are not covered. They are bloody and rough. I was picturing something cleanly sliced, like the edge of a deli ham. I look at the heads, and then I look at the lavender tablecloths. Horrify me, soothe me, horrify me.
Mary Roach, welcome to Fine Print.
Thank you, Rick.
Mary Roach is a journalist who writes the My Planet column for Reader's Digest and has written for Wired, GQ, Outside, Discover, and Salon.com. None of this prepares the reader for her first book, Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. Mary, tell us how and why you started writing.
How and why I started writing? That's easy. I was a typical liberal arts major who graduated with absolutely no marketable or practical skills, and found that writing was something I actually could do and seemed to be able to make a living at, and so I stuck with it.
How did you break into journalism?
I started out actually, I had a job at the San Francisco Zoo in the PR office. I worked out of a trailer next to Gorilla World, and writing press releases about elephant laser wart surgery and things like that. And I enjoyed that quite a lot, but the job kind of petered out, and I started doing some writing for the San Francisco Examiner Sunday magazine, just kind of sent a query in one day, thought, let me try this, and it kind of grew from there, kind of random.
You're one of the top writers in this nation. You're working for those prestigious magazines, Wired and GQ, Outside.
Stop it.
Well, now, how do you organize all this stuff?
Poorly. I'm not a terribly... what I do is I don't take on too many things at once because I have a low stress threshold. So I tend to just have one or two things going at a time. So it's pretty simple when you...
How do you select or reject your assignments?
Will it be fun and interesting, really? I have kind of a combination of variables that I look at. Is the publication prestigious, something I'd want to work for? And if so, I'm willing to do something for less money. So it's a combination of the publication, the payment, and the topic. But mostly the topic.
You will write a column for Reader's Digest, which is one of the oldest and most staid publications on the planet.
Yeah, go figure, huh?
What's it like? What's it like being part of such an ossified institution?
Oh, that's a very good question. The Reader's Digest is actually trying to change their image. This is why they called me and a couple of other columnists to do something for them. They're trying to appeal to younger readers so that they went just about as far out on the limb as they could go in having me do a column. Obviously, I'm not writing about cadavers for them. It's sort of a personal look at my life. I write a lot about my husband Ed, who's kind of a goofball. But they're actually in some ways just like any other magazine. They do have some some interesting editorial habits. Like they are only comfortable condensing. If you ever write a feature for them, this may have changed recently. I don't do features for them, but they have a tendency to assign a piece at twice the length that they will run it because they just have this need to condense. We are Reader's Digest. We need to condense. It's like, what if I turn it in right at the length you want? No. We can't handle that.
You're a woman writing in the field of science. How has this impacted your work?
I'm a contributing editor at Discover, and I used to work with an editor there named Fred Guttural, and we had this running joke where Fred would, you know, if I'd be working on a story and I'd get something wrong or there'd be some problem, Fred would just go, "God, you just can't let women cover science." It was just this ongoing theme, I'm kind of a lame science writer in that I used to turn in stories with be a lot of description and a lot of, you know, characters and dialogue, and then I'd have a paragraph like just go science TK, and that would be the last thing I'd stick in, and invariably, depending on which editor I had, they'd just get exasperated and write the science section themselves. So, I'm science light. I'm really not one of the big boys, I'm afraid.
How did this book, Stiff, come into being?
Stiff actually grew out of my salon column. I covered health, medicine, the human body for their section, Health and Body. And I ended up one day sitting on an airplane with a man who worked in the crash test dummy business. And he was talking about how in the early days of crash test dummies, in order to calibrate them, they needed to take cadavers and explore what the limits of the human body were to being, say, hit in the head with a windshield or hit in the chest with a steering wheel, because the crash test dummies would just tell you how much force the crash was unleashing, but it wouldn't tell, without knowing what does that force do to a human body, it was meaningless information. Anyway, I was just found this fascinating. I didn't know that cadavers had these sort of extracurricular activities, and that was one column I did. I did another column that had to do with it was a Thanksgiving column. It was about some research that had been done on how much the stomach could hold before it bursts. Because I used to think every Thanksgiving, but can I keep going? Is there some point where my stomach will explode? And in fact, the cadavers were used at some point in the 1800s. There was a French and a German study. So that was another column.
Well, and you have to tell us.
4,000 cc's, 4 quarts. Yeah.
A gallon.
Obviously, you can work your way up beyond that. I mean, there are some serious eaters who obviously have surpassed that. Your Guinness World Record holders. Orson Welles, one famous occasion, I think ate 18 hot dogs at Pink's hot dog stand. So anyway, we were going to do a whole column called The Deadbeat on Salon, but the funding was cut. I was left with research that I'd done, talked to an agent. There you go. There's the book.
How did you select the postmortem careers covered in this book?
The postmortem careers in this book are the most interesting and fascinating and bizarre that I came across. And really most of them. There's not much that's left out, mm-hmm. that you can get up to as a cadaver. There's really not much is left out. There aren't that many things you can do as a dead guy.
Tell us a bit about the history of surgery and the body thieves who might have supplied Victor Frankenstein.
Yes. Well, in the early days of anatomy schools, the only cadavers available for dissection were convicted murderers. Part of the penalty for murder was that you were hung and then you were given over for dissection. And that was a huge deterrent because the populace at the time felt that it would ruin your chances of, you know, the resurrection, of going, you know, ascension into heaven, because you know you'd be all dripping on the floor and missing parts, and that would quite a deterrent. So consequently, because there were so few bodies available for all these anatomy schools in England and Ireland, Scotland, and eventually in the U.S., there was this whole underclass of thugs grew up who would go out to cemeteries, case the cemetery by day, see that there'd been a funeral, come back at night, dig up a fresh grave, take the body out, put all the dirt, the coffin back in, and take it over to the anatomy schools and sell it. And it was actually quite a decent living at the time. And that, I mean, the you know, the anatomy instructors weren't thrilled about this, but they had no choice. So it was kind of, if they wanted to keep doing, offering anatomy courses and dissection, that was really the only way they could get bodies.
One of the instructors actually went to a little more trouble to get his bodies, didn't he?
There was an instructor named Knox who had a couple of body snatchers, Burke and Hare. Burke and Hare, I think, just out of sheer laziness, decided, you know what, why dig them up when you can just kill them? And they ran a boarding house. One of them had a boarding house, sort of a flop house, and drunks would come in and pass out. And they developed this method where one of them put a pillow over the guy's face and the other would lie on his chest so he couldn't breathe, and it was called burking, came to be known as burking. And they killed about 15, 16 people and sold them. Is that what you were referring to?
Yes. Tell us about the experiments that were made to determine the weight of the human soul.
Ah, yes. That was a Dr. McDougall who in 1907, and I actually tracked down the journal article that he wrote about this. He had a bed that had a scale incorporated into it, a very sensitive scale, sensitive for the time, and he would install dying patients on the scale. And he had, I guess, would be watching constantly I guess he must have had a stethoscope to one ear and then an eye on the scale, and the moment they died, he looked to see if the needle ticked down at all, which would indicate something had disappeared when they died, and he determined it was the 3/4 of an ounce change, and that was the soul leaving the body. And of course, he was roundly criticized. There was a debate that went on for months after that in that particular journal, but he stood by his conclusions.
Stiff addresses a lot of misconceptions about the process of decay. The old saying recommending that one live fast, die young, and leave a beautiful corpse kind of misses the point, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's really no point leaving a beautiful corpse because presently it's going to be not beautiful. There really isn't any way to remain attractive and youthful and in death, but Lord knows people have tried. And in fact, in the old days of embalming, the undertakers would claim that their technique would preserve you, you know, in eternal comeliness. And they would actually have best preserved body contests among themselves to try and figure out, you know, what's the best formulation so that the person keeps yet doesn't pickle or mummify. And they would, you know, publish photographs in their journals of the winner, and then give the formulation. So they used to make claims. They're not allowed to now. The government forbids that.
Tell us a bit about the challenges that people who wish to use human cadavers face in obtaining a cadaver, the postmortem paperwork.
You need to be a credentialed academic or researcher or surgeon, medical. I mean, you need to have a legitimate reason to be messing around with a cadaver. You cannot, for example, I got a call a couple of weeks ago from a documentary maker who wanted to know whether I thought he could get a cadaver. He was doing a show on human sacrifice. And he was talking about the Aztecs and saying they killed 20,000 in 4 days. I've worked out that's 3 to 4 per minute. I don't think you could get the hearts out that quickly. I'm wondering if I can get a cadaver and get a surgeon to take an obsidian blade and make an incision and pull the heart out and see how quickly he can do it so that we can verify that, in fact, you could do this 3 or 4 times in a minute. Do you think I could get a cadaver? And where? And I said, well, first of all, you'd need a legitimate PhD researcher and who is, you know, doing a, you know, like a history thesis or something. And even then, probably not. But as a documentary filmmaker working on a Discovery Channel documentary, no, you are not going to get a cadaver and rip its heart out. I'm sorry. you really have to prove that you have a legitimate reason and that it's something. I think, you know, similarly with animal research, that, you know, mm-hmm. it can't have been done before. You can't be, you know, duplicating something that's already known. You really have to make your case that you can't do your work without a human cadaver.
Once you've got your case, your little paper written up, yep. Where do you go?
human cadavers come from when you donate yourself as to research, you fill out a willed body form at a for a particular university, a medical school. Mm-hmm. So when you die, they come and pick you up and take you to the university, and then the willed body program coordinator looks at his list of who needs what. About 70-80% of them go to anatomy labs for dissection, and the remaining ones are parceled out according to who's got what project and what need. So if you were a guy working in an automotive safety impact lab and you needed a cadaver, you would let them know, and eventually they call you up and say, well, we've got somebody here, would you like to come look? Because they,
oh, you get to shop?
You do get to shop. You get to shop around, actually, because sometimes the cadaver may be too old. Like in an automotive impact test, you know, if the bones are very brittle, it's not going to be very representative. The average person in an accident is pretty young. You know, 18-year-old male is probably the average age of a head-on car collision. So an 80-year-old guy is not going to be very representative. So, you know, they yes, you can... You can yay or nay the guy on the slab.
Now, you can so you can only leave your body to a university? I mean, couldn't I? What if I wanted to leave my body to the Discovery Channel to have my heart ripped
out? Oh, they'd love you. They would love you. I suppose if you put it in your will. I mean, there was a guy who, in his will, said, I want my, he was an actor. He said, I want my skull to be Yorick in our theater, our Shakespeare theater troupe. And my understanding is that they had that done. I don't know where. I mean, there are facilities that clean bones for museums, and perhaps he got one of them to do it. Hopefully they didn't, you know, do it at home. But go ahead.
Okay. Death is a little more complicated than it used to be. It's a very difficult subject. Could you talk about brain death and organ donation and, quote, true death?
Yes. Brain death is the legal and accepted definition of death in our society, in this country. So you can be, if you're in an accident and you're whacked very hard in the head and your brain is no longer functioning, your brain dead, yet you're on, if you're put on a respirator, your organs can keep going. You can keep the heart and the organs functioning for a matter of time until for transplantation. So you have what's you end up with this entity known as a beating heart cadaver. And I actually spent some time in an operating room with a beating heart cadaver whose organs were being taken out for transplantation. There was a guy who came for the heart, someone else came for the liver and kidneys. And this is a very strange thing to see, because this individual is dead, and yet you see the heart, I mean, literally, because the body, you know, the body cavity has been opened up, you see this heart beating, and you see, you know, and the flesh is, you know, warm to the touch, and the, everything is, you know, working and functioning, and yet this person is dead. And it's a very odd, especially in a culture that for centuries has thought, you know, of the self as the heart. You know, every love song is about, you know, my heart, and you say, you put your hand on your heart when you think of yourself. And so that has, the brain death kind of threw people for a loop. For I think it took people a while to adjust to that, and so you do have families who say no to organ transplantation, I think because they're uncomfortable with the thought that they may, in sanctioning the removal of the heart, the beating heart, actually themselves be committing the final act of, I mean, in a sense, murdering the person, even though they're not, because the person is brain dead. It's, you know, I think death is a it's a continuum more than an exact point. And I talked to heart transplant surgeons who said, I don't know that you can say somebody brain dead is dead in the final sense, but the in-between state of being brain dead is not something anyone would want. I mean, you are, they're pretty certain there's nothing going on there.
When was the legal precedent for, legal and scientific precedent for brain death established?
In the 60s, there was a committee report that was published in the Journal of, I don't know exactly, I'd have to look in the book for exactly, I think it was the JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. And it was right around the time of heart when heart transplantation was first happening. In fact, there were some coroner's offices who were saying if you take that heart out, you know, I will initiate murder charges because the heart is beating, the person is alive. And before the concept of brain death became accepted, heart transplantation had some difficulty being accepted.
Now, as a fan of bad horror movies, I insist that you tell us a bit about the head transplants.
Ah, yes, the head transplants. there was a neurosurgeon, Dr. Robert White, who became fascinated with the possibility that you could keep a brain alive outside of a body. And so he actually was able to do this. He would take, because if you have a brain, as long as it has a blood supply, this brain will continue to function as a brain.
A brain in a bell jar?
A brain in a bell, yeah. Actually,
wow.
even better than that, he took brains and he would like stitch them into, he was doing this with dogs initially, dogs and monkeys. And he would take a brain and like stitch it into an abdomen or a thigh and attach the arteries so that this brain, and you could just imagine if you were this dog, I mean, you couldn't see anything, but you'd know something was up. You would like imagine what it would be like just to be a brain inside someone else's body cavity. Anyway, so that was his, and then that was his first, the first step. And then he decided, you know, what if could you keep a whole head by perfusing it with blood? If you keep a actual head of a monkey, if you keep it alive outside off of a body, why not stitch it onto another body and literally transplant a head from one body to another? And he succeeded in doing this. And you may be saying, why? Why would you spend all this time trying to transplant one monkey's head onto the body of another? And his feeling was that, and this is actually, you know, there is some logic to this, that if you had an individual whose body was failing, something was failing in their body, what major organs were collapsing and they were going to die, if you could take that head off and reattach the arteries to another body, you could then extend that person's life. Obviously, he would be paralyzed from the neck down because you can't reattach the spinal cord, but you would have, as Dr. White called it, you know, you'd be a head on a pillow, but you would be alive. And he was saying you could continue to, you could enjoy music, you could you could watch films, you couldn't talk, I think, because you're breathing through a tube. Essentially, he compared it to Christopher Reeves. I'm sure Mr. Reeves would not really appreciate that, but it is a similar, I mean, you know, you'd be paralyzed from the neck down, but your head would be functioning. So there you go. That's the story of the head transplants.
Well, we have time for just another quick question. What are you working on next? How do you follow up post-death?
Aha. Well, having spent so much time with dead bodies, I'm actually the next book, I can't really say too much about it, but it has more to do with the soul.
Oh,
wow. Science and the soul.
Science of the soul.
It's more fun things in weird labs.
Oh, well, that sounds great. We've been talking with Mary Roach. Her new book is Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers.